Good morning, everybody. Today is Wednesday, November 22nd, 2017. And this is Before the First Cup with Jules here on UCY.TV. Happy Wednesday, everyone. It is a chilly and overcast 34 degrees with light snow here in upstate New York. So where do we leave off yesterday? We titled the show Smart Cities, IoT Beer, Internet of Things at Heineken, AI Church, Brain Computer Interfaces, Robot Doctor, and Skull Drill. We talked about some of these new robot surgeons and one that could, in record time, drill holes in your skull. So you have to be a little concerned about that one. Well, today we are going to continue looking at some artificial intelligence in healthcare. We talked yesterday about the robot doctor in China that had passed his medical exams with flying colors, and now he was going to have to go in rotation and start learning how to interact with patients. But, you know, don't think that that isn't going to be in our future. I've joked before about Dr. Smartphone, and we have looked at Dr. Watson. We're going to take a little look at Dr. Watson here a little bit down the line and then continue into life sciences and some of the crazy stuff that is going on in nature. So there was a story that came out of MIT Technology Review titled, Can AI Keep You Healthy? I don't know. Good question. A Chinese entrepreneur wants to track your health data and suggest ways to improve, but are computers really smart enough to make sense of all this information? This smart mirror isn't very smart, says Zhu Wang, standing in front of a full-length mirror wearing designer jeans ripped at the knees. It is just a camera and a mirror, he says, looking mildly distressed, or as distressed as possible for a man whose face is perpetually unperturbed. Now this, I got to tell you, when I read this article, somebody went way out of their way to like add all kinds of things. So we might skip forward here in a little bit. What I want is a mirror that does a 3D scan of me, he says, using his hands to trace the contour of his thighs and here, and Wang indicates his belly, which is lean. I want an exact 3D figure of you, the fat, the muscle, the entire body shape, plus facial recognition and what is going on with your skin. He points to the top right area of the mirror, and he says, I want readouts about my health up there, next to where I am brushing my teeth, my weight, blood pressure, and heart rate, and how does that correlate with my DNA? This is an as-yet-unrealized smart mirror and is just one of several gadgets that Wang, a 41-year-old biologist and computer scientist turned entrepreneur, says that he is building. The devices will help gather, analyze, and display a crush of health data that he wants to collect about himself, and he hopes from millions of other people. This is why Wang co-founded iCarbonX, or ICX for short, a highly ambitious, if not quixotic, personal health company based in Shenzhen, southern China. ICX wants to capture more data about your body than it has ever been before possible, and it wants to start with your DNA sequencing that includes data from Fitbit-style wearables that measure your steps, your heart rate, and your sleep patterns. Add in frequent blood testing to measure various proteins and enzymes that can, say, reflect the health of your heart and signal very early signs of cancer. Include with that monitoring of the ever-changing levels of metabolites produced in the body as it processes food, traditional blood tests on levels of cholesterol and glucose, heart rate data from an EKG, and information from your medical history. And the goal is continuous monitoring of your health and suggestions of adjustments that you might make in your diet and your behavior before you slip from being healthy into the early stages of an illness. Now, I was thinking about this. This sounds like something that they would like to have in NEOM. We talked about the Saudi smart city and the coming of the smart cities globally in the not-too-distant future. And this would be a way to personalize healthcare and keep the cost down, of course, giving up all of your data to the machine. And they even say it, this sounds a little like personalized medicine, which has been discussed for years, but for Wang, this is not about treating disease. It is also about what might be termed personalized health. Right now, you don't know your temperature or your pulse or the microbes inside of you that affect your emotions, he says, or what to do if you have an allergy or if you want to lose weight because you're fat. This vision of personal health monitoring is becoming achievable in part because of the dramatic cost reductions for sequencing DNA and measuring many of thousands of biological compounds and processes that regulate the body. What all that means for any one of us, especially when all the readings are combined, is unclear, but ICX is part of a new wave of companies that figure out if they can find something meaningful in your data and enable medicine to stop merely reacting to an illness that you might have. And these companies want to keep you healthy at a fraction of the cost. That's how they're going to sell it. You'll only get health insurance if you tie yourself into the machine. Unlocking this puzzle, you remember we read about the Panopticon a long time ago and the daily monitoring of everything that you do. And you will have that dangling carrot of protection if you step right up and enter yourself. Unlocking this puzzle with its millions of moving pieces is where AI and other advanced computing techniques will have to come in. AI is how we take all of this information and tell you things that you don't know about your health, says Wang. And assuming that it works, putting all of this together will not be cheap. As the CEO of ICX, Wang has raised $600 million to fund the effort, a remarkable amount of money for a project offering high-tech tests for healthy people. But he will need it and probably more, and everything with everything that they want to test, says Eric Schott, a computational biologist and mathematician who recently stepped down as director of the Mount Sinai ICANN Institute for Genomics and Multiscale Biology in New York. Schott has launched his own health company called Semaphore, with the letter, number 4, which is scanning genomes and molecular biomarkers. ICX is using a pile of cash in part to invest in or acquire companies that might contribute to Wang's holistic vision, and this included a $161 million stake in Colorado-based SomaLogic, which is working on a chip that can measure 5,000 proteins in your blood, and then another $100 million in Patients Like Me, which is a company out of Cambridge, Mass. That provides online platforms to more than 500,000 patients to share experiences, metrics, and their feelings about health and diseases. And then another $40 million in AO Biome, also out of Cambridge, Mass., which sells spray-on microbes that say it makes your skin healthier. Get your spray-on microbes here. I mean, that's nuts. ICX also recently invested in a health tell of San Ramon, California, which identifies antibodies from a blood sample as clues to the presence and progress of disease, including cancer and autoimmune diseases. Additionally, ICX is also collaborating with several companies in China. Tying this eclectic alliance together in his aggressive effort to build an artificial intelligence system that will attempt to analyze all of this data. And that is being led by Israeli-based iCarbon X Israel, in which ICX acquired last year. Founded in 2005 as Imagu Vision Technologies, the company developed software to interpret CT scans and other medical images. And now ImagNews engineers are working with counterparts at ICX to create what they call a virtual health brain that will interpret the thousands of data points ICX wants to collect on each and every customer. We want to create a tool that not only analyzes data, but offers ways to help people improve their health and like how to alter their diet to get the desired results, says ImagNews CEO and co-founder Mor Amiti. If all this sounds ridiculously complicated, it is, says Wang, smiling in a way that blends reassurance, which undoubtedly is appreciated by investors, and his bemusement as if he knows that what he is proposing sounds a bit daft. But then the question is, can he use his money and technical savvy to revolutionize medicine? Well, that gets us to precision health. A tall man, and this is where it kind of gets real flowery, a tall man with short black hair, Wang strolls coolly through his company's headquarters, a Silicon Valley knockoff with open workstations, glass-walled conference rooms, and a gym, as well as a cafe, always stocked with food, healthy drinks, tea, and coffee. Like, do we really need to know all that? It is on the third floor of an industrial park building in a complex of similarly unexceptional structures, tucked between two sprawling wooded theme parks called Happy Valley and the China Folk Culture Village. Like, what do they have to do with the story? In the back of ICX's headquarters is Wang's office. a comfortable niche with deep leather chairs and a private conference room, a business setting that is a long way from where Wang started as an academic researcher sequencing DNA at Beijing University in the late 1990s. Wang has authored over 100 studies as a professor of the University of Copenhagen and as a bioinformatics whiz at Beijing Genomics Institute, which he helped found in 1999. The Beijing Genomics Institute was the organization that led China's relatively small contribution to the Human Genome Project, which was a worldwide effort in which several countries worked on different segments of the human DNA sequencing, published in 2003. Beijing Genomics Institute later churned out the first complete DNA sequence of an Asian person, a strain of rice, the SARS virus, and the giant panda. During his stint as CEO, Wang helped build the community into one of the largest sequencing operations in the world. Leave it to the Chinese. And in 2016, it had a revenue of $250 million, and this summer it had issued an IPO. Wang remains a major shareholder and a member of the board, which makes him probably quite wealthy. But he left BGI in 2015 because he was frustrated by the limitations of genomics. Specifically, sequencing DNA doesn't provide much insight into the health of most individuals. Scientists have found countless DNA markers that seem as if they should help determine whether a person should be healthy or sick, but those markers have turned out nearly 15 years after the completion of the Human Genome Project to make less of a difference than originally thought. With the exception of certain rare genetic mutations, DNA is just one determinant of a person's medical fate. It turns out that you also need to know about proteins and metabolites and all the rest, says Wang. So soon after his departure, Wang formed ICX, knowing that he would do something with AI and health, but he wasn't exactly sure what data besides DNA the company could or should collect. But remember, in China, they don't have any privacy protections. To figure it all out, he met with a range of experts and companies, including pivotal meetings in July 2016. And in pitching ICX to investors and prospective partners, Wang had arranged to see Jamie Haywood, the co-founder and chairman of Patients Like Me, who was visiting from Boston. They sat in a booth in a truck stop style cafe, and it didn't take them long to realize that they shared a fundamental exasperation with the limits of today's medical practices. Given more data seems like a promising route, and Patients Like Me, which runs a service where thousands of members discuss their various chronic diseases in online forums and provide metrics about their health and progression of their disease, they've already shown the value of careful health tracking by individuals. And like, who would have thought that careful health tracking wouldn't be something that your doctor should be helping you do? So I don't know if I want to continue on here because this is just a lot of gobbledygook now, blah, blah, blah. But let's get into another MIT Technology Review story. And this is about IBM's Watson from June of 2017. My dad really likes Watson. He thinks Watson's going to be huge. I mean, I joked about Watson quite a bit when we first started hearing about him in oncology and working with all the different hospitals to diagnose cancers. Well, this is a story from June 2017, a reality check for IBM's AI ambitions. And I have a little insight into IBM I'm going to share with you as we continue down the story as to why I think IBM has internal issues that might limit it. IBM, number 39 on our list of the 50 is smartest companies, overhyped its Watson machine learning system, but the company still could have the best access to the kind of data it needs to make medicine much smarter. Paul Tang, with his wife in the hospital just after her knee replacement surgery, a procedure performed on about 700,000 people in the U.S. every year. The surgeon came by, and Tang, who himself is a primary care physician, asked when he expected to be back to her normal routines and given his experience with patients like her. The surgeon kept giving vague non-answers. And it finally hit me, said Tang. He actually didn't know when she would be back up and around. Tang would soon learn that most physicians don't know how their patients will do in the ordinary measures of life back home and at work, and the measures that matter most to patients. Tang still sees patients as a physician, but he is also chief health transformation officer at IBM's Watson Health division. That is the business group developing healthcare applications for Watson, the machine learning system that IBM is essentially betting on for its future. Watson could deliver information that physicians are not getting now, says Tang. It could tell a doctor, for instance, how long it took for patients similar to Tang's wife to be walking without pain or climbing stairs. Well, maybe they should partner with that company that the other guy was partnering with. What was their name? Life something? Or they have 50 or 500,000 people sharing their real-time experiences. One of the things I wanted to mention about this whole experience asking a doctor questions and them giving vague non-answers, as I went through that, as I shared with you back in June of 2017, where the whole time I was in the hospital, I kept wishing for Dr. Watson to come get me out of the quagmire where everyone was trying to pass the buck between the different specialists and nobody had an answer for me at all. Anyway, Tang says it could tell a doctor, for instance, how long it took a patient similar to Tang's wife to be walking without pain or climbing stairs. So wait, Tang's wife, hold on, let's go back. Tang was with his wife. So Tang is the head of IBM Watson Health. And his wife had a knee surgery, and that made him realize that healthcare in the 21st century really actually does still kind of suck. It is because possibilities like this that healthcare is one of the hottest segments of the market for machine learning technologies. Research firm CB Insights counts that at least 106 startups that have sprung up since 2013 are still in the business. None of those companies has garnered anywhere near the attention that Watson has, thanks to his victory on Jeopardy in 2011 and the zealous marketing by IBM ever since. But lately, much of the press for Watson has been bad. There was a heavily promoted collaboration with the Anderson Cancer Center in Houston that fell apart this year. And as IBM's revenue has swooned and his stock price has seesawed, analysts have been questioning whether Watson will actually deliver much value. Watson is a joke, says an influential tech investor who founded the VC capitalist firm Social Capital. And however, most of the criticisms of Watson, even from MD Anderson Cancer Hospital, doesn't seem rooted in any particular flaw in the technology. Instead, it is a reaction to IBM's overly optimistic claims of how far along Watson would be by now. And in fact, it seems that Watson Health will be a leader by applying AI to healthcare woes. But if Watson has not, as of yet, accomplished a great deal along those lines, one big reason is that it needs a certain type of data to be trained. And in many cases, such data is in very short supply or difficult to access. And that is not a problem unique to Watson. It is a catch-22 facing the entire field of machine learning for healthcare. Though the problem of missing and inaccessible data may slow Watson down, it may hurt IBM's competitors more. That is because the best bet for getting data lies in the close partnerships with healthcare organizations that tend to be technologically conservative. And the one thing IBM still does very well in comparison to startups or even giant rivals like Apple and Google is gain the trust of executives and IT managers in a big organization. Now, one of the things I want to tell you too about IBM, we used to work very closely with a lot of the big vendors many years ago when I was in distribution. And I was an IBM specialist as well as HP and Compaq, and we used to configure their servers frequently. And one of the things that I noticed about IBM as compared to their competitors is that IBM always seemed to be top heavy. They had a lot of managers and not a lot of workers who, I don't know, they were probably well taken care of. And it was a good environment. I had friends that went to go work there. But one of the things that IBM had a problem with was putting out documentation that maybe wasn't always as accurate as it should be. We would get configuration guides on a quarterly basis for all the newest products that were coming out. And one of the things that IBM always had a bad habit of doing was putting incorrect part numbers in their guides. So when you went to go give someone who just spent $100,000 on some big server cluster, a new hard drive. Whoops, you gave them the wrong hard drive. They just spent $1,000 that now they got to try and return, and they already opened the package, and it was all your fault. But it really wasn't. It was the book that gave you the wrong part number. One of the other things that they used to do that I noticed, and you got to wonder if this doesn't carry through, because we are still talking about computer technology here, is they made things way more difficult than it had to be. Companies such as Hewlett-Packard or Compaq always had, they would have a line of machines. So, you know, let's say they had the Titan line or whatever. And there were maybe five or six machines starting at the lower end all the way up to the higher end. And in the higher end, you could jack them up with as much memory and processors as you could possibly imagine, of course, for a price. But one of the things that was interesting is that HP and Compaq always had the capability that within a single family line, many of the components were interchangeable. So if you bought a low-end machine, you would be able to upgrade that machine over the next 5 years or so with hard drives and memory and processors without having a worry. But what IBM did is that within a single family line of servers, they were so complicated. Every single model within that line of servers used different hardware. And they had another bad habit. They would release an entire product line, and within like the first month, they would start discontinuing products with no replacement. And within, you know, a month or so, they would come out with a workaround, and their workaround was some convoluted way where you had to add on all these weirdo parts and then take a hard drive from another machine to retrofit it into your current machine that you just spent $20,000 or $30,000 on to make it work. I mean, it just, honestly, I never had good experiences configuring IBM servers, and I did them as my tertiary skill because they always gave me a nervous breakdown. So anyway, getting back to Watson, so let's hope they didn't continue that trajectory. Anyway, the Cancer Center, this MD Anderson that they broke up with, they partnered with in 2012, and the goal was for Watson to read data about any patient's system, symptoms, gene sequencing, and pathology reports, and then combine it with physician's notes and relevant journal articles that may help doctors come up with a diagnosis and treatment. But IBM and MD Anderson both overinflated expectations of the technology, and IBM claimed in 2013 that it was a new era of computing that had emerged. Remember, they were calling it cognitive computing, and gave Forbes the impression that Watson was now tackling clinical trials that would be used in patients in just a matter of months. And I thought we saw a video in regards to that. In 2015, the Washington Post quoted an IBM Watson manager describing how Watson was busy establishing a, quote, collective intelligence mode between machine and man. The Washington Post said that the computer system was, quote, training alongside doctors to do what they can't. And in February of this year, 2017, the University of Texas, which runs MD Anderson, announced that it had shuttered the project, leaving the medical center out $39 million in payments to IBM, holy crap, for a project originally contracted at $2.4 million. So, yeah, it started at $2.4 million, and they had to keep upgrading and upgrading to $39 million in payments. And, you know, that's how they get you once you get in with a vendor. And that's kind of how working with companies such as Cisco, that's one of the things they used to do. If you had a lead, they would go in there against all their competitors and basically give such massive discounts, like 60 or 65% off list, just to get their product in the door. Because once you got the product in the door, you could keep doing add-ons. And once your technology was in there, you pretty much had them locked in. And that's how you grew a large account. Well, after 4 years, it had not produced a tool for use with patients that was ready to go beyond pilot testing, and MD Anderson would not comment about Watson specifically, but it appears that the problem stemmed mainly from internal struggles over how the project was managed and being funded. And that is not to say that IBM has no troubles with Watson. Indeed, they are larger than what any one implementation reveals. You always want to try to brush these bad implementations under a rug. To understand what is slowing the progress, you have to understand how machine learning systems like Watson are trained. Watson learns by continually rejiggering its internal processing routines in order to produce the highest possible percentage of correct answers on some sets of problems, such as which radiological images reveal cancer. The correct answers would already be known so that the system could be told when it gets something right and when it gets something wrong. The more training problems the system can chew through, the better its hit rate gets. So there's a whole ton of information that has to go in front, except humans are bad at putting information into databases, and that's the big trouble. Everything's got to be in a database before you can start running learning algorithms against it. And that is relatively simple when it comes to training a system to identify malignancies, but for potentially groundbreaking puzzles that go well beyond what humans already do, like detecting the relationships between gene variations and disease, Watson has a chicken and the egg problem. How does it train on data that no experts have already sifted through and properly organized? If you are teaching a self-driving car, anyone can label a tree or a sign so that the system can learn to recognize it. But in a specialized domain in medicine, you might need experts trained for decades to properly label the information that you feed to a computer. So some versions of that stumbling block emerge in every domain in which IBM hopes to have Watson contribute. So this is another wah, 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 wah. And so as it does for any company's machine learning solution, and to train Watson to go through giant pools of data and then pull out a few pieces of information important to a single patient, someone has to do that by hand first and for thousands and thousands of cases. So to recognize genes linked to a disease, Watson needs thousands of records of patients who have specific diseases and whose DNA has been analyzed. But those gene and patient record combinations can be hard to come by. Except remember, there was something called the cohort program as part of the National Institute of Health, where they wanted you to check that box every time you went to 23andMe and offer your information up for research purposes. In many cases, the data simply does not exist in the right format or in any format at all. That is all the different data silos that we used to talk about, or the data may be scattered throughout dozens of different systems and difficult to work with. Consider, for example, the goal of improving primary care by placing better data at the fingertips of clinicians. When doctors miss chances to treat relatively minor concerns during a routine primary care visit before a more advanced problem sends a patient to an emergency room, their health suffers and costs can explode. And about one-third of every dollar spent on health is probably unnecessary, they say. So machine learning is widely recognized as an opportunity to address that problem. All right, this is getting boring and it's very winding. So here's another one that I had up here a while ago. We never got to it. And then, I don't know, my browser crashed. I lost all my tabs. So we're going to get back to it because I think this kind of tail feathers right in with what we are talking about. There is an initiative by Mark Zuckerberg and his wife called the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative, and they are proud to fund 38 pilot projects to help build tools and technologies for the Human Cell Atlas. Yes, it's not just a now human genome project. We have something called the Human Cell Atlas. The Human Cell Atlas is a global collaboration to map and characterize all of the cells in a healthy human body, and that would be your cell types, your numbers, locations, relationships, and the molecular components. Once complete, there will be a fundamental resource for scientists and AI, allowing them to better understand how healthy cells work and what goes wrong when disease strikes. We are proud to support the following efforts to build new technologies, best practices, and data analysis techniques for the Human Cell Atlas. Learn more about each project. Okay, well, number one is the brain. And hold on 1 second, because this is really tiny typing. Let me blow this up a little bit. These projects seek to continue the development of technologies, many from the neurobiology field, that address the specific challenges of single-celled analysis of primary human tissues. They're also benchmarking existing tools and methods against each other and across regions of the nervous system. Number two would be the immune system. These projects look at multimodal analysis of the current methods of the immune system to develop rich single-cell analysis, evaluate inter-individual variations, and more reliably detect cell types known in rarity and compare tissue-resident immune cell populations. Number three is gastrointestinal. These projects study diverse approaches to preservation and processing of tissue from the often sensitive organs that are critical for nutrient uptake and metabolism. And that would be your gut microbiota, I would guess. Relatively little is known about the diversity of cells that comprise these tissues and differences among their distinct spatial compartments. Number four would be the tissue handling and processing. Oh, no. These projects seek to establish best practices for processing heart tissue and other tissues that are notoriously difficult to process. Studies will test multiple protocols and methods on multiple tissues and deposit data from common sources for robust benchmarking. Number five, I think that is skin. Human skin is a wide range of cell types that exist in relatively well-described spatial distribution. These projects will use their empirical knowledge to generate benchmarks across assays to reveal cell type biases and also inform tissue isolation and preservation techniques. This is from Zuckerberg Chan. These projects will develop technology and computational tools that can increase the scale of single cell analysis, identifying systemic errors among collections, and increase detection signals for sequencing and imaging. And I bet it's all about a healthier future for our children. Oh, yes. Look in your smart mirror, get your spectroscopic photograph, and it can tell you what ails you. So now let's continue beyond here. Hold on 1 second. Because I had a story here about a brand new camera utilizing spectroscopy. Researchers develop spectroscopic science camera for smartphone-enabled mobile health. And this was from September 14, 2017, out of biosciencetechnology.com. The latest versions of most smartphones contain at least two, sometimes even three, built-in cameras. But researchers at the University of Illinois would like to sell mobile device manufacturers on the idea of adding yet another image sensor as a built-in capability for health diagnostics, environmental monitoring, and general-purpose color sensing applications. 3 years ago, the National Science Foundation provided a pair of University of Illinois professors with a grant to develop technology called Lab in a Smartphone. And over that time, the research teams of Brian Cunningham, Donald Bigger Willett, Professor of Engineering, and John Delanese, Associate Professor of Electrical and Computer Engineering, have published papers detailing potential ways that mobile devices could provide health diagnostic tests and other measurements normally performed in a lab setting. Their latest efforts demonstrate that mobile devices incorporating their sensors can provide accurate measurements of optical absorption spectra of colored liquids or the optically scattered spectra of solid objects. In other words, the mobile device incorporating the Lab in a Smartphone science camera could accurately read liquid-based or paper-based medical tests in which the end result is a material that changes from one color to another in the presence of a specific analyte. The team successfully demonstrated a very compact, inexpensive system that performs optical spectroscopy in the form factor that can fit inside of the body of a cell phone. It uses inexpensive components in the same kind of LED being used for flash illumination in phones already. And by adding a special component attached to the top of a conventional smartphone image sensor, they were able to measure the light absorption of liquids and the scattering spectrum of solids. Now, how messed up is this? They could put this right into your smart mirror. Here, stand still for the camera there, Jenny. We're going to take a photograph of what is going on with your body. We have several projects where we look to use the sensing capabilities of smartphones and mobile devices for point of use biomedical tests or tests that could be performed away from a laboratory. But in all the projects that we've worked on so far, there's been a cradle or some other instrument that the phone has to be in contact with to perform that measurement. However, in their latest paper, Integrated Spectroscopic Analysis System with Low Vertical Height for Measuring Liquid or Solid Assays, published in Sensors and Actuators B, details how smartphones could directly be placed over a cartridge containing liquid to measure a specific color of the liquid, and the results could then be directly sent electronically to a physician who can make a diagnosis and suggest a remedy without a patient needing to see a physician in person. To make this work, smartphone manufacturers would add a camera for scientific purposes, and the pixels of the additional image sensor would have linear variable filters glued on top of that to transform the camera into a spectrometer. Since the components will be an integral part of the phone, the information gathered by it can be seamlessly integrated with other information about the patient and the test being performed, while the interaction of a cloud-based smart service system that provides immediate actionable feedback. Could you imagine utilizing spectroscopy? We read about some of that with terahertz lasers being able to detect molecular substances at something like 167 feet away. They were called molecular scanners. You know, spectroscopy is a way that they can determine elements that are in an environment, and they can be used for sensing applications and some of the stuff that they were utilizing in some of those scanners at the airports as well, looking for explosives and things of that nature. Just think about that. You're going to have a spy device in your medical smartphone or in your smart mirror someday in your smart city, in your smart apartment. This is just pretty nuts. But they're like, oh, it's all to keep healthcare costs down. And if you want insurance and to be insured by your 21st Century Cures Act, you're going to have to comply. To prove the concept, they accurately measured the liquids of a fetal fibronectin enzyme linked to immunosorbent assays, which is a protein whose concentration is used to help determine the likelihood a pregnant woman would give birth prematurely. Kenny Long, an MD, PhD student in bioengineering whose research focused on the clinical applications of the medical technology, led that effort. And other students or postdocs involved with the project include a whole bunch of people out of China, which I'm not going to read all their names. Without our approach, it is possible to roughly measure the color of an object using red, green, and blue pixel intensities from a smartphone image. However, you get more rich information when you measure the whole spectrum and can extend the detected wavelengths into the infrared. So more specifically, this technology uses illumination from a bank of light-emitting diodes, or LEDs, which then are gathered into a cylindrical plastic rod. The rod collimates the light and sends it to a test point in front of a camera, and the system allows only one wavelength to pass through the camera at a time, but the selected wavelength is linearly variable across the width of the camera. All right, we don't need that level of detail. So anyway, let's get down to the meat and potatoes. Where does this go? Fundamentally, though, he's hoping to take advantage of the landscape where phone companies are already thinking about using their devices for mobile health. Remember, I already had one of those for monitoring heart rhythms. It was my doctor's smartphone I had to wear all the time. I think mobile health is going to mean medical diagnostic tests for nutrition and wellness, a service that these major smartphone companies can help provide. And they're looking for ways, and even to Africa, and they're looking for ways that healthcare can fold in with their capabilities because there's money in it. And we are hoping to find companies that are interested in differentiating their phones from others by having this capability. And here we have it. Hidden government scanners will instantly know everything about you from 164 feet away. And that was the story. This is back from 2012. We had read about this. They are using molecular level scanning in airports and at border crossings to be able to quickly identify explosives, dangerous chemicals, or bioweapons at a distance. Well, the reason why I mentioned that is because I came across a story while I was reading The Pentagon's Brain, DARPA, by that Annie Jacobson. I was sitting waiting for an appointment, and there was a whole section about an experiment that they had been doing at Los Alamos National Laboratory in New Mexico utilizing bees. And they were training honeybees to be able to detect explosives. And according to the book itself, it said that this project never actually got off the ground, but I found a 6-minute video today that shows them actually experimenting with the bees and how they train them. They utilized a Pavlovian response. I figured they would have genetically modified them at some point, but they didn't mention that. They utilized a Pavlovian response to teach these honeybees to be able to detect not only TNT, but also C4. And any time that they smelled it, they would stick out their little proboscis, bloop, bloop. And they had them in a little box. It was the craziest thing I'd ever seen. This is talking in mad science, gets into life science. They had them in this little box. They had like a big magnifier on them, and you could see them magnified in the window. And as they scanned this box with the bees in it across like somebody's vest, and the one vest was clean, the other vest had stuff in the pockets, and then a truck that was clean, and then one that had like loaded with C4 inside. every time they scanned these bees past something with an explosive, they stuck their little tongues out, bloop, and DARPA was there to watch it. It was some sort of DARPA-financed project at Los Alamos Laboratory. But the reason why I thought of that is because I ran across another story today that, again, is completely bastardizing nature in order to use it for the war machine and to make it into a surveillance device of some sort. We had read a story back last year about them making bomb-sniffing spinach. And I don't know if you remember that one, but I remember covering this because there's an update to the story. This one was out of the Washington Post, November 1st, 2016. These bionic spinach plants can sniff out bombs. So we have bees and spinach that are sniffing out explosives. MIT researchers have engineered a bionic plant that can detect explosives and send a warning signal without wires to scientists nearby. In a new paper in the journal Natural Materials, scientists explain how they can turn plants into bomb-sniffing machines with the help of tiny cylinders of carbon that can detect nitro aromatics, which is the chemical compound often used in explosives. As the plants absorb air and groundwater from the environment around it, the carbon tubes will register any nitro aromatics and begin to emit a fluorescent signal. The signal gets picked up by an infrared camera and relayed to a small computer or a smartphone, which then sends an email to the user. So what are they going to do, plant spinach in the desert? This is a novel demonstration of how we can overcome the plant-human communication barrier, says paper co-author Michael Striano, a chemical engineer at MIT. And though he and his colleagues work with spinach plants, you can apply these techniques to any living plant and turn them into any kind of sensor, he says. Well, now let's fast forward to a DARPA project. This came out this morning, newatlas.com. Plant spies, DARPA plans to create organic surveillance sensors. There are plenty of gardeners that talk to their plants in the belief that it'll help them grow. And while plants aren't likely to be eavesdropping on our conversations anytime soon, we hope, they could be gathering different types of intelligence if a new DARPA program bears fruit. The agency is pursuing research into genetically modifying plants to turn them into self-sustaining surveillance sensors. This puts a whole new meaning to smart dust. Let's just turn all the blades of grass against us. The Defense Advanced Research Project Agency, more affectionately known as DARPA, is essentially the U.S. government's major technology research arm, Mad Science Lab, dedicated to developing innovations that strive for transformational technological change. And if that wasn't an elevator pitch, I don't know what is. Just this year, we saw a landmark announcement from the agency directing funding to a new gene editing technology as well as development into brain-computer interface devices. Now, I would argue about that because I've been covering DARPA for probably 5 or 6 years now, and they were talking about brain-computer interfacing and messing around with chemicals for a very long time. It wasn't just this year. Maybe some of the stories came out this year, but we had found little blips on the radar long before now. And their new gene editing technology was that Safe Gene Project, if you remember. And that was to be able to put a digital rights management on your genes so they couldn't accidentally or on purpose gene edit you. They want to be able to reverse that. The latest program to be revealed is called the Advanced Plant Technologies, or APT for short, and is currently seeking proposals from the science and technology community on the potential ways that plants' physiology could be appropriated to, quote, detect chemical, biological, radiological, or other nuclear threats, as well as electromechanical signals. The aim of the program is to genetically modify certain plants so that specific response mechanisms are triggered when they are presented with specific stimuli. It is suggested that existing hardware can be used to remotely monitor these responses, so the plants could essentially be used as organic sensors. But as such, the program won't seek to develop new hardware for this purpose, but are relying on existing technologies that can already measure things such as the plant's temperature, chemical composition, and reflectance. Plants are highly attuned to their environment and naturally manifest physiological responses to basic stimuli such as light and temperature, but in some cases to touch, chemicals, pests, and pathogens. emerging molecular and modeling technologies may make it possible to reprogram these detections and reporting capabilities for a wide range of stimuli, and that would be maybe even your spectroscopic camera on your cell phone, which would not only open up new intelligence streams, but also reduce the personnel risks and costs associated with traditional sensors. No specific plants or external stimuli have yet been specified, as DARPA says that these details will be clarified as the research proposals are evaluated. However, the initial announcement does add to that goal. It is to modify multiple and complex traits to give plants new capabilities that enable them to sense and report on numerous stimuli. Now, frightening is that we had read about the gut bacteria that they were engineering that could report back to what was going on in your gut, and now they're going to engineer plants that can sense and report back to headquarters what is going on in its environment. Of course, all of these preliminary studies will be contained in laboratories, so thank goodness, or greenhouse environments, or simulated natural environments, and only if the research proves successful in field trials will field trials take place. That's the genetically modified sensor grass out there that's getting to me. Will the first trials take place under the watchful eye of the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Services? So what do you think of them apples? Well, I found another story, and this one came from the horse's mouth itself. This was out of DARPA's publication, DARPA.mil. Nature's silent sentinels could help detect security threats. The new program envisions plants as discrete, self-sustaining sensors capable of reporting via remotely monitoring program responses to environmental stimuli. Few military requirements are as enduring as the need for timely, accurate information. Of course, they are developing this for the military. To meet this demand, the Department of Defense invests heavily in the development of powerful electronic and mechanical sensors and in the manpower to maintain and operate those sensors. DARPA has been involved on the research side of the equation since the agency's earliest days, developing mad science technologies such as satellites and seismographs to ensure the Soviet compliance with nuclear test ban treaties. And today, nearly 60 years later, the need for information is no less urgent, but the national security landscape has grown far more complex, and the challenges of monitoring distributed activity is far more complicated. The military's traditional sensors are not always optimal for that task. So fortunately, nature is the master of complexity, and it offers potential solutions as we take it over. DARPA's new Advanced Plant Technology Program looks to seemingly simple plants as the next generation of intelligence gatherers. And the program will pursue technologies to engineer robust plant-based sensors that are self-sustaining and can be remotely monitored using existing hardware. DARPA's vision for the APT is to harness plants' natural mechanisms, and it plans to modify the genomes of plants in order to program in specific types of sensing and triggering discrete responses to in the presence of a stimuli, and so do so in a way that does not compromise the plant's ability to thrive. If the program is successful, it will deliver new sensing platforms that are energy independent, robust, stealthy, and easily distributed. Oh, throw some of that spygrass on the lawn there, Jenny. This is just nuts. Such sensors could find application outside of the military as well, making it possible, for instance, for communities to safely identify landmines or unexploded ordnances left over from past conflicts or testing grounds. Plants are highly attuned to their environments and manifest physiological responses to stimuli, but they also, in some cases, they can detect touch, chemicals, pests, and pathogens. They aim to go far beyond the current practice, which tends to pursue only a minimal number of modifications. Uh-oh, they're going to make these things walk and talk. DARPA's goal is to modify multiple and complex traits to give plants new capabilities that enable them to sense and report on numerous stimuli. Maybe they'll splice some human genes in. To succeed, however, the program must also address how modified plants allocate internal resources and compete in the natural environment. And I don't know if anyone's watched any of Stranger Things, but I just finished season two yesterday. And let that be a lesson to anyone who is working on genetically modifying complex traits of plants, because that thing took over, man, and was all underground and making these tunnels. It was crazy. The past experiments of this type have reduced the fitness of modified plants by siphoning resources needed to sustain the plants, but APT will seek to improve how plants collect and distribute their resources and optimize their fitness so they can't be killed, so that modified plants thrive despite anticipated interactions with natural stressors such as microbes, animals, insects, and other plants. So when is this happening? Well, they are accepting proposals through this December of 2017. So this made me think of another program that DARPA had running, and this was under the name of Mad Science Taking Control of Nature and Biology, and this was their Insect Allies program. Insect Allies, combined with genetically modifying plants, brings you a little bit of dystopia. Researchers at the Boyce Thompson Institute of the University of Minnesota, as well as the University of California, Davis, and the Iowa State University, have received a four-year, $10.3 million award to engineer insect vector viruses. So remember, we've talked about insects used as biowarfare vectors in the past. A lot of that research happened at Plum Island. They've been tinkering around with doing things to insects for a very long time. Well, what this project is doing is taking viruses, and we've already seen this with some of the other technologies where they've been using the adenovirus to they suck the guts out, and then they put other things such as CRISPR into that, and then use that to infect an organism to then go in and treat cancer or something like that. Well, they're going to basically do the same things to insects. They are going to engineer insect vectored viruses. They'll be viruses that live inside of insects to express genes in maize, or i.e. corn, that can help combat disease, drought, and other yield reducing stresses. The research project, titled Viruses and Insects as Plant Enhancement Resources, more affectionately known as VIPER, is supported by the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency's Insect Allies program. The vision of this group was to develop insect-vectored viruses that can be used to modify crop plants to respond to emerging threats in real time, and that would be fully grown crops. They are going to create a genetically engineered virus and then insert something into it, and then send these infected insects into mature crops to then, as they eat the crops, infect the crops to genetically modify on the fly. We responded to this challenge by proposing to engineer maize viruses, aphids, leafhoppers, and such that they can be deployed rapidly to change gene expression in mature maize plants. The productivity of maize, which is the most economically important crop in the United States, can be negatively impacted by insect pests, droughts, and other environmental stresses. And about 30% of maize productivity worldwide is lost to pests and pathogens, and drought can lead to a complete crop failure. Although classical breeding is commonly used to improve maize, the process is slow, and breeders often are unable to respond quickly enough to new threats. So other responses to biotic and abiotic threats include the use of chemical pesticides and irrigation, and it can be expensive, inefficient, or cause unwanted environmental damage. So let's make our Frankenstein bugs. So together with the VIPER team, we will engineer viruses that activate desirable traits in mature maize plants, insects that efficiently transmit these viruses, and mechanisms to prevent the unwanted spread of the virus to viruses and insects to non-target plants. The project brings together seven scientists with diverse areas of expertise. And I'm not going to read all these scientists. And although the ultimate goal is to develop viruses that can be used to transiently modify mature maize plants in the agricultural field, it is important to note that VIPER is focused on solving fundamental scientific questions of the feasibility of it all and all the current work that will be done in greenhouses and growth chambers. No genetically engineered viruses, insects, or plants will be released into the environment as a part of this study. They make sure they tell you, but maybe accidentally. The biggest impact of the VIPER project will be the development of a toolkit to rapidly counter sporadic and emerging threats to this valuable crop. And the methods will be developed by the Viper team because it's all in the name of national security. And it will be useful for basic and applied maze research and eventually may be deployed in a similar manner to other important crop plants. Now, think about this. We actually listened to quite a number of interviews by Dr. Huber. If you guys remember him, Dr. Huber spent a lot of time studying plant and crop pathology as well as animal pathology and spent a lot of time at the, I'm trying to remember the name of the bio lab down in the East Coast. I don't know, Fort Detrick, Maryland, working with the military on not only curing and protecting against, but they also were working on how to create bio warfare for plants. And one of the scariest things about that is some of these technologies, we've talked about this before, genetically modifying insects with genetically modified viruses that then could be passed to crops. I mean, that's what they worry about, that we might get attacked by an adversary with some sort of insect that would decimate our crops that then we wouldn't be able to protect against, and we would, of course, all starve because our most prominent crop in the country has been attacked. Well, one of the things I noticed is they have a lot of collaboration here going on with Cornell University. Cornell University was the place that had done some collaboration with that Oxitec. I don't know if you remember Oxitec, the creator of the genetically modified mosquitoes. Well, they had also worked on genetically modified moths. And genetically modified moths were released in New York State, I believe it was last year, let into the wild. And the public was not informed, and people were freaking out because these genetically modified moths might lay their larvae on some organic cabbage crops. And what was that going to do if people ate these genetically modified larvae? And that is the question, people. They are tinkering with all of this nature and biology. I mean, genetically modified spinach to detect bombs. I don't know about that one. So where is this going to lead, and how are we going to protect our food supply? I thought a long time ago in our readings from Dr. Arnston and talking about making edible vaccines, they decided a long time ago they were going to stick to non-food plants for things such as tobacco so they couldn't accidentally get mixed up in the food supply. But it's really got to make you wonder, as they are conquering biology, where this is going to leave us in the future. And last but not least, I had one more. If I have a second, I actually forgot to open it, so I had to go get it. This was titled Radio-Controlled Genes out of IEEE Spectrum. Peter Parker gained the ability to sense imminent danger thanks to a bite of a radioactive spider. And now researchers have enabled rat brains to sense electromagnetic fields thanks to genetic modifications